This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today. What do you know about the food we produce in Wisconsin, and in the Milwaukee region in particular? Well, you're going to know a lot more by the end of this week. Today, we kick off our latest Project Milwaukee series called What's on Our Plate? Over the next 5 days, we'll explore not only what kinds of foods are made in our region, but the impact that slice of the manufacturing sector has on our economy. We make frozen pizzas in Milwaukee, but we also make the flavor of the soda you drink along with a pizza. And of course, we make beer. More on that later today. There's soy sauce, a lot of soy sauce, organic milk and cheese. It's a long, long list, and it adds up. More than 250 food and beverage companies employ almost 15,000 people in the Milwaukee area, paying those workers almost $600 million a year. We're going to start our Project Milwaukee series today by asking why it is such a long list. What has led to the development of the food economy in Wisconsin? Historian John Gerda has some answers, and he joins us now in the Lake Effect studio. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be back, Mitch.
What was the food industry here before there was really an industry here? What was being grown before the first white settlers came, if you will?
I think the stereotype is that Native Americans were largely hunters and gatherers. They depended on wild plants and wild game. They were actually gardeners, and in the years before white settlement, almost farmers. There was a site on Milwaukee's south side around Forest Home Cemetery the early whites called Indian Fields, and it was about a half a square mile of corn ground. So the fertile soil here was absolutely as important to the natives as it was to the Europeans who arrived here. And what they would do was, no, they didn't have oxen and plows, but they would girdle the trees, and that meant taking a strip of bark from around its circumference. The trees would die, so over the years, you'd have a large area of cleared land, and they would also burn land, and sometimes to drive game, but also to clear land for agriculture. And there's a wonderful book by Curtis about the vegetation of Wisconsin. He said that there's no reason that a fire started on the Mississippi could not have swept all the way east to Lake Michigan. So this landscape was really in very, very many ways modified by native settlement, both for hunting and for agriculture. There are some early accounts of the fur traders. This goes back to the 1700s, who said that they were coming to Milwaukee certainly for furs, but they were also coming for corn. So the agricultural products of the native era were as important in many ways as the furs.
How was Wisconsin's agricultural tradition shaped by who it was that settled here? Did people settle Wisconsin because it offered something that was already offered where they were leaving?
Two answers. First of all, you have the first generation coming from upstate New York and New England. So these are people who were already on American soil, who were accustomed to American agricultural practices. And what they grew in their old homes was wheat. So you have this crop moving west with the settlers. And wheat is hard in the soil. It takes a lot out of the soil. And what they were doing basically is burning out the fields in New York State and transplanting those crops here and just being just as hard in the soil in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin was just next.
It was next. It was next in line. And by the 1850s, Wisconsin was among the top two or three wheat states in the entire country. This is not long after the state's chartered, which takes place in 1848. And Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha, Sheboygan, Manitowoc, these are all ports for the movement of grain to market on the East Coast, but Milwaukee became the most important. By the early 1860s, Milwaukee is the largest shipper of wheat on the planet. So this was absolutely a close tie between city and country. So you have, first of all, these crops being transplanted from old sites in New York and New England. The other movement, obviously, was from Europe, all the immigrants coming from the old country. And in many cases, there is almost no comparison between agriculture and the old world and agriculture and the new because the farms were so small and so intensively farmed. In the United States, you have all this land for sale for a buck and a quarter an acre. So these guys are claiming 160 acres, often with trees, trees included, which was just backbreaking to clear. But in the end, they had these farms that would have been not just the envy, but in outer space compared to what the pattern had been in the old country. And they would adapt to what the markets were here. And that would have been, obviously early on, wheat grown for grain, and then you move into dairying in the later 1800s.
Well, and so let's talk about the dairy tradition because we all know about it. But what can you tell us about why Wisconsin has such a dairy tradition? Why are all the cows here versus some states that might be similar, like Michigan or Ohio, for example?
You've got some pushes and some pulls. First of all, you have wheat burning out the soil, and that meant that it was no longer a viable crop to be grown in Wisconsin. And it moves, keeps on moving west. It's kind of this wave, you know, the waves of amber grain kind of keep on moving to the west. So it settles in Minnesota and the Dakotas and Montana, and they learn how to dry farm, sort of fallow, you know, year fallow and a year cropped. So they learned how to manage it, and those are still the wheat-producing states of this country, especially out in Montana and the Dakotas. So that was no longer as viable an option in Wisconsin. So people were looking for something to do. They were looking for something to replace wheat. King wheat, as they called it, you know, had lost its crown. And they were looking for something to replace it. So there was a period where it was mixed farming, you know, some livestock, variety of small grains. And then by the years after the Civil War, you know, 1870s, there was a missionary named William Dempster Hoard, H-O-A-R-D, who ran a publication called America's Dairyman out of Fort Atkinson, still there. And he was nothing less than a missionary, spreading the message that the cow, you know, will lift your mortgage, the cow, you know, will use your grain and add to its value. The cow will take you to market through cheese in a way that's not as perishable as some of the grains. So he really was absolutely key in convincing a major proportion of Wisconsin's farmers to switch to dairying. You also had a landscape that was well-watered and relatively flat, but rolling, so pasture land was extremely important. It's something you couldn't have done in Montana, obviously, and something you couldn't have done, you know, probably in the South. It would have been hard on the animals to have such heat, and obviously in the Southwest. So there were geographic advantages. You also had in time a very aggressive role of support played by the university, and that was hugely important. One of my uncles took the short course in the ag school at Madison, and it sort of lifted him to a different dimension in his home farm out there in the southwestern part of the state. So that became very important as well. And the butterfat tester, scientific agriculture, the university played a very important role in there. So it was kind of this symbiotic relationship of a charismatic missionary, a very supportive university, farmers looking for something else to do, and a market. And that all came together to make Wisconsin America's Dairyland.
We hear now about the dichotomy between the large-scale farming operations and the smaller family farms. Obviously, when this first started, there were far more family dairy farms out there.
Sure.
Was it ever at a point where it afforded, if not an easy lifestyle, a more lucrative lifestyle than it does today?
I'm not sure about lucrative. I think most farmers would laugh when you say easy lifestyle.
Well, right.
I have a cousin. My mom's side of the family is from the southwestern part of the state. She was raised in a dairy farm outside Coon Valley. And I have a cousin who's been active in agriculture out there. And his line, I think it's so true today, he said, farming's not hard anymore. It's just expensive because it is so technologically dependent. And you travel the countryside and harvest today, compared to what it had been in the 19th century, it's quiet. It's one guy out there on his tractor pulling a combine. So it's quite scaled down in terms of labor from what it had been. For my uncle's generation, I think that it was probably more than subsistence. But my Uncle Lawrence in Coon Valley, I think he never had more than about 30 cows. And that's a small herd by today's standards. And he shipped grade B. He shipped to the creamery in Coon Valley, which meant butter and not fluid milk. And the saving grace they had out there was that they could grow tobacco, which was an incredibly lucrative cash crop. They could make about $1,000 an acre from tobacco. And that's not in the food business, but it certainly is part of Wisconsin agriculture. Another very large area of tobacco cultivation around Edgerton, Stoughton, Dane County. I think that getting rich quick was not something any farmer would ever aspire to. But I think the independence, the constant contact with nature was, in their eyes, vastly preferable to a wage worker in industries in places like Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha.
Well, and so if agriculture was one of the key drivers of the economy early in Wisconsin's history. Manufacturing took on a huge role as the state developed. At what point do manufacturing and agriculture start to mix and blend, and we start to see the food processing industry become
early
important?
Early on, very early on. In the very first chapter, and you're talking 1830s for settlement in the state and in the Milwaukee area, shipping was what Milwaukee did, and Racine and Kenosha, other lakeshore cities. Raw materials went out, especially that grain. But very early on, we're talking 1840s and 50s, people realized that it was more advantageous to add the value here. So instead of just shipping wheat, they would turn it to flour, and Milwaukee became a major milling center. Instead of growing livestock and shipping them east, you know, the hogs and cattle, they would butcher them here. And the outsides went to tanning factories, and the insides went to meatpacking plants. So early on, you have that kind of industry. In the same years, 1840s and 50s, barley grown in the countryside is converted to malt, which means you sprout the barley grains and then dry them, and that provides the raw material for beer. And that becomes, obviously, a huge Milwaukee and Wisconsin industry. So early on, I'm talking the first decade or two of settlement in this state, you have begun a move from shipping to processing. Then the next step up is when you begin to get into heavy manufacturing, 1870s and later, almost instinctively, a lot of the manufacturers would look toward the agricultural market for applications for their products. And those would include people like Jerome Increase Case, J.I. Case, you know, harvesting machinery. International Harvester had a huge plant here in Milwaukee. Alice Chalmers made tractors beginning in 1914. And the Alice Chalmers orange was kind of ubiquitous in large areas of the countryside. So there was a strong continuing connection between urban industry and rural agriculture that played out in the manufacturing sector.
Is there a time that you can pinpoint the heyday point of Wisconsin's role in feeding the country or the world, or are we still there?
I think it's had different incarnations over the years. Certainly in the 1860s, when we were this huge shipper of wheat, we were the supplier of grain for not just this country, but a lot of that went overseas as well. In the more recent past, we were a source of fluid milk for a wide region. And we are still, California notwithstanding, we are the nation's largest manufacturer of cheese. So the heyday continues. It's not wheat as it had been for our great-great-grandparents, but we are still, as a proud part of America's Dairyland, the number one maker of cheese. And everything else, from ambrosia chocolate to food flavorings, places like Sentient, you know, it continues.
Do you think, and this is a question I think we're asking a lot, is food almost a recession-proof industry? I think, you know, when we talk about the trouble that, say, a company like Harley-Davidson has, we hear much less about food industries doing poorly in a recession.
I think that's true. I think the balsamic vinegars may not do as well in a recession. But basic foods, obviously, we all have to eat. And some of the more sophisticated value-added things may not do as well, but people still have pizza every weekend, and they still drink milk with the morning cereal. I think that is something that is absolutely a staple that is, in fact, recession-proof.
John Gerda, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Mitch.
John Gerda is a Milwaukee historian, the author of 19 books, including The Making of Milwaukee, and he's our regular Lake Effect History contributor. John Gerda did not speak much about Milwaukee's brewing history. That is by design. We will find out more about the city's brewing tradition from two beer historians next on Lake Effect.